Well, we're in the book of Job, chapter 22. As of last Sunday, we're halfway done. 42 chapters, we finished chapter 21 last week, so we're halfway through. You see on your outline, I've got the title of the message, A Matlock Maneuver. I like to watch or have in the past old movies and old series, Matlock being one, even earlier than that, Perry Mason. Everyone familiar with Perry Mason? And what I like to watch, enjoy watching, is courtroom scenes of a trial. I like to watch the lawyer, you know, pin someone's hide to the wall, and like to watch, you know, the debate go back and forth. And I just enjoy trials, watching trials on TV. And if how many of you watch Perry Mason, familiar with Perry Mason, the show, and have watched them in the past, okay? If you remember Perry Mason, and after you watch five or six of them, you've kind of seen how everything is going to go. You know, there's a bad guy, somebody gets killed, and they arrest somebody, and he's, you know, the prosecuting attorney and the law are just certain that he's guilty, and he's in jail or she's in jail. And everybody just, you know, thinks it's a clear-cut case except for Perry Mason. And Perry Mason believes them when they declare their innocence, and so he sets out to prove that they're innocent. And always, you know, there's a show is kind of gathering information, and then right toward at the end of the show, the last 10 or 15 minutes or so, you're in the courtroom. And I always liked when they got to the courtroom, so I could watch the questioning and the answering. And if you remember Perry Mason, I wish I was an impersonator, but I'm not. But they go through there, and at some point along the way, Perry Mason will be start these rapid fire questions. And they seem to always start, "Isn't it true?" Right? You remember that line? "Isn't it true that you got in the car that night? And isn't it true that you snuck back in the house after dark? And isn't it true that you broke out the window? And isn't it true that you did this?" And these questions just come and come. And eventually, the guilty party, which may be on the witness stand or maybe out in the crowd or, you know, whatever, but eventually someone will say, Okay, I did it. You would have too if you'd have known what I had to go through, what I went through, and all this stuff. You know, they crack, and the whole thing blows open. And you can count on kind of that scenario with every show. Matlock came, I think, along a few years later. At least the ones I've seen were in color, and Perry Mason was black and white. So Matlock is similar. But Andy Griffith is different than Raymond Burr. And Matlock is kind of the same line. There's someone that declares they're innocent, and Matlock doesn't believe it, and he won't take their case, but they finally talk him into it, and so he does. And he becomes to believe they're innocent, and so you go through the same routine, and they get in the courtroom, and it's the same, kind of the same idea. And Matlock's approach is a little different. Matlock's, what I call Matlock's maneuver, is after he gets through trying to establish some facts, then he begins this rapid-fire dialogue. But here's his more like this. He would say something like, and this is what you did. You took the car and you ran it off in the lake. That's what you did. And then you went back to the house and you climbed in the window, didn't you? That's what you did, didn't you? And he keeps on, you know, just on and on and on, and sooner or later they crack. And they, yes, you know, it was me, I did it. And so you can kind of depend on that same situation, same scenario with every show. I thought of that. as I was reading our text for today, chapter 22, and we're not going to read the whole chapter to begin with. We'll read the parts to it as we come. But I'm calling this a Matlock maneuver because it seems like Eliphaz does this. This is Eliphaz's last statement that he will make. So you might say the judge is offering him his closing statements, and this is it. Now, I don't know if Eliphaz knows that he's not going to speak again. I don't know that. We don't have that information. But we know it because he doesn't come up again in the dialogue. You know, we went through all three of these guys, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have had their turn twice. They each went through twice. Now Eliphaz is starting with this chapter, the third round of dialogue and debate with Job. Perhaps unknown to Eliphaz, this is his last time. Perhaps he knows it. We just don't know. But regardless, this is it. And Eliphaz, you remember John McCarty called him Eliphaz the Elegant because his speech has been a little more sophisticated. It's been a little more easy to follow. It's been a little more sensitive, perhaps, and not as harsh and bold and blunt as some of the rest of them. But this time it's different. This time Eliphaz's speech turns into the speech of a pious man who is on a hunt for heresy. A righteous man, a religious man who is unleashing himself in looking for error, looking for wrong, and in finding it as quickly as he possibly can. You remember also that the worldview of all three of these friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and perhaps Job as well, is that God always punishes sin. And also that bad things always are a result of sin. So when we suffer bad things, when you suffer discomfort, when you suffer evil or bad things come up on you, whether it's from someone else or just the consequences of your own actions, that is a result of sin. And the worse your discomfort, then the greater the sin. It's like, as you're here on Wednesday night, the speaker a couple weeks ago on our videos we were watching had a couple of statements that stuck with me. One of them was that God has a cash register sense of justice. And what he meant by that was, it's like you go to the store and you buy something that costs $10 and you give the cashier a $20 bill. You're going to get $10 back. Things are going to be exchanged. There is an equal and an exact exchange of value. And in their way of looking at life, God doesn't have one of these little penny cups, take one, leave one cups. God's justice is exact. And that's the way they look at life, it appears, from the 20 chapters that we've looked at. That when you have bad things come upon you to the degree that they are hurtful to you, that is the same degree to which you deserve them. So that's their outlook on life. And they think that it is always that way. There is no exceptions. The second thing that the speaker 2 or 3 weeks ago said that stuck with me, just had a good analogy for that. He asked, these three guys are asking Job, they're saying, Job, do you think, and this was his term, that God is going to turn the order of the world upside down just for you? You're crying out that injustice has been dealt to you, And yet we know that the natural order of justice is what you reap is what you sow. You reap 20, you get 20. Do you think God's going to lay that aside, to turn that on its head, just because you, Job, think you have been mistreated? So they look at this situation and they look at Job as if that is a total impossibility. I think Job himself at least started out with that type of mentality. That's why this is so puzzling to Job, because he cannot see that his calamity anywhere compares to his sin. That's why he's so troubled. That's why he's so puzzled. That's why he's so having such doubts about God's justice. So Eliphaz begins, and this is our first point, that God has no motive or reason to violate the natural order of justice. God has no motive, God has no reason to violate his own natural order of justice. Now let's read verses 1 to 5. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Can a man be profitable to God, though he who is wise may be profitable to himself? Is it any pleasure to the Almighty that you are righteous? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways blameless? Is it because of your fear of him that he corrects you and enters into justice, judgment with you?" Let's stop with those first four verses. Eliphaz poses some questions to Job. And the expected answer to all of these questions is no. That's easy to see. What are the questions that Eliphaz asked Job? He says, "Job, does God get anything from you? Is there anything God needs from you? Do you have anything that would benefit God if he were to take it from you? Or if you were to give it to him?" And the answer he's expecting is obviously no. God is so great. God knows so much. God sees so much. God has so much power. God has so much knowledge. God is so far higher and above us that there is absolutely nothing you could give to God that God would say, "Oh, I'm glad I've got that. I needed that." There's absolutely nothing in your life, nothing that you have, that would benefit God if he had it. In other words, God is a disinterested party in this idea of justice being meted out. God is not biased. God is neutral. God just sees that justice is carried out in the world. And Eliphaz is telling Job that, and here is the almost irresistible conclusion that you can come to, is that Job, God does not care in the sense of trying to figure this out between this doubtless trouble between you and him. God is a disinterested party. He just is the judge. He just metes out justice. That's it. He's not going to do you any favors. He's not going to do anyone else any favor. It's just an eye for an eye. What you reap, what you sow. Now, what conclusion can you draw if that is the way life is? Verse 5, he asks one more question. "Is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end?" If God is a disinterested party, Job, and I know all the things that have come upon you, I know what's happened to you, what other conclusion can we come to, Job, is that your sins must be horrific. They must be innumerable. for all these things to have come upon you, because God gives out eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, tit for a tat. So that's Eliphaz's first point in his prosecution of Job, that God has no motive. God has no ulterior motive. God has no motive at all in looking at Job. God has no reason to violate the law of justice in the world. If that's the case, then Job's sin must be great. Point number two. Eliphaz says, in a sense, if you won't confess your sins, then I'll do it for you. If you won't crack, if you won't admit that you have erred, that you have sinned, then I'll tell you where you've sinned. I'll lay it out before you. You know, we've spent all this time trying to get you to see it and trying to get you to admit it. You won't do it, I'll do it for you. And we'll read what he says. But it was one thing before we read, I want you to notice about this list, this laundry list that Eliphaz begins to name. The things that he names, are abuses that would be found in someone that is wealthy. Someone who had influence, someone who had power. It's not, Job, you stole money out of the petty cash drawer. It's not those type things that a poor person could commit this crime. These things that Eliphaz lists are things that only a powerful, a rich, a wealthy person could commit. Now let's look and see what he says. Begin in verse 6. For you have taken pledges from your brother for no reason, and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have not given the weary water to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. But the mighty man possessed the land, and the honorable man dwelt in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. Let's stop there for just a minute. So look at the list of things that he does. He says, you have taken pleasure. In other words, you have come into an agreement with someone that they're going to provide you a certain service. And he says, for no reason. You could have made this agreement with someone, but no, you, in other words, we might use it this way, you required some collateral. You couldn't just help someone. You have to have some collateral. You have to have some type of a pledge of what they're going to do for you in return. A poor man doesn't make that kind of agreement. He's in no position to make that kind of agreement. He's on the other end of that scenario. So that's one thing that he said. And you end up stripping the naked of their clothing. When they don't are not able to live up to their agreement, you take from them even to their clothing that they have on their back. Everything you can take to satisfy that debt, you take. Verse 7 says, you're not given the weary water to drink. Perhaps this is a reference to just the type of agricultural community perhaps where Job lived. He had that much livestock. There was lots of area around him. And probably one of the greatest offenses that you could commit against a stranger that was passing through was not letting them have water. If someone came through and passing through on a journey, it was a horrible slight to say, no, you get your water at the next place. And he says, Job, you won't even give the weary water to drink. You won't even give the hungry food to eat. It says in verse 80, he kind of turns and describes Job. Job, you were a mighty man in the land. You were a person of influence. You were this mighty man that possessed the land. You were this honorable man, in quotes, that dwelt in this land. This is you. You were an honorable man that dwelt in the land. You had the wealth. You were a mighty man in the land, and that you, verse 9, sent widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. Starts naming these things about Job. You know, it wasn't, I should have looked this up before. I just thought of it, but it wasn't back in chapter 4. The same Eliphaz, I want you to listen to what he says. You have instructed many, talking to Job, this is Eliphaz's first round. It's in Job chapter 4, verse 3. You've instructed many, you have strengthened weak hands, your words have upheld him who was stumbling, you have strengthened the feeble knees. Does this sound like the same guy he's talking to? No, somewhere along the line, Eliphaz has changed his tune. Somewhere along the line, Eliphaz has changed his approach. Way back in chapter 4, he was getting Job to see, you know, Job, you were a great man. You were a very helpful guy. But now that this stuff has come up on you, you know, you're crying foul. But here in chapter 22, he's changed his story. He's decided that undoubtedly there is something horrible about Job that we did not know. And so he lists all these things. I can see Matlock with Job on the stand. Can't you? You know, Matlock might would say, Job, what kind of car do you drive, Job? Oh, Cadillac, Rolls Royce you've got there. You've got all these sheep. Job, lots of sheep. All these things. And yet somebody comes to help you, you take everything they've got. Widows. You had a financial arrangement with a widow. And where's this widow now, Job? And he starts laying this out. And Matlock, as you would, I can picture Eliphaz probably perhaps the same way, becoming more agitated and more forceful as he reads off this laundry list and just unloads on Job with the evil things that he's certain Job has done. The difference is Job doesn't crack. Job doesn't confess. Job doesn't give in. Job perhaps remains silent. Job doesn't acknowledge that, yes, you're right, I did all these things. These things that apparently are just the imagination of Eliphaz. He goes on and says, because of this, because of all that you have done, in verse 10, these snares are all around you, and sudden fear troubles you, or darkness is upon you that you cannot see, and an abundance of water covers you. So he uses all these analogies to paint a picture of the troubles that Job is in. He is overwhelmed with the flood. He is like he is in a darkness that cannot be seen. The snares and the troubles that come upon him. And then in verse 12, Eliphaz repeats something that Job had kind of hinted at earlier. He says, Is not God in the height of the heaven? And see the highest stars, how lofty they are. Yet you say, where is God? He says, Job, you think God is so far away that he can't see what you've done? You think God is so far away and so far removed from you that you could get away with all of this? Can God judge through the deep darkness? Thick clouds cover God so he cannot see. And he walks above the circle of heaven. You think that's the way it is, Job, that God's not going to see what is going on? No. Obviously, he doesn't expect that to be. But Job is not shamed into confessing something that he is not guilty of. It's good for Job. It is good for Job at this point that the only power his friends have is the power of words. Because doubtless, if they had the power and the ability to exact punishment on him, they would. But all they can do is mouth off. And that they do well. Point number three, Eliphaz goes on. And perhaps Eliphaz calms down a little bit. Job is not given in. And Eliphaz mentions two more things. Verses 15 to 20 is the first one. He asks Job a question. He says, Job, have you not been paying attention? Have you not been paying attention to things around you? Have you not been paying attention to the way life works? How many wicked people have you known that eventually what goes around doesn't come around? Eventually it catches up to them. Begin reading in verse 15. Will you keep to the old way which wicked men have trod, who were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away by a flood? Now here it's interesting, he mentions a flood. And I don't know if this is a reference to what we call Noah's flood or not. Perhaps it was. It would be a very appropriate thing to say, because it would be something that would fit the context of what he's saying. He says, have you not been watching? Even in, if he was talking about Noah's flood, before the flood, the world was wicked, and they get caught up to him. They caught up to him. They were swept away. They said to God, verse 17, depart from us. Get away, God. We don't want anything. We don't need you. We don't want you in our lives. We don't want to mess with you. They said, what can God do to us? Yet he filled their houses with good things, but the counsel of the wicked is far from me. The righteous see it, verse 19, and are glad, and the innocent laugh at them. Verse 20, surely our adversaries are cut down, and fire consumes their remnant. Eliphaz tells Job, says, Job, just look. Just think of all that you've known, the people that you've known. This is what happens. Wicked people, eventually it catches up to them. Eventually they suffer the consequences of what's going on. And then 21 to the end of the chapter, Job, or Eliphaz, makes an appeal, a soft appeal, you might say, to Job to turn back to God. Now let's read these verses and see what he says. Notice, we'll try to point out the imperatives as we come to them, the instructions, you might say, that he gives to Job. First one is in verse 20. Acquaint yourself with him. Job, acquaint yourself to God. Some versions say submit yourself to God. Get to know God and be at peace. Therefore, good will come to you. Verse 22, what does he tell him? Receive instruction. Receive instruction from God's mouth and lay up his words in your heart. This is good advice, isn't it? It is. Receive instruction from God. Lay up his words in your heart. If you return, verse 23, if you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tents. In general, a good principle. If you live for God, there will be peace in your home. There will be iniquity will be far from you. Now, I'm not saying that's an undeniable promise necessarily, but in general, if your ways please God, God makes men to be at peace with you, Proverbs said. 24, then you will lay your gold in the dust, the gold of Ophir among the stones of the brook. I'm not sure what this is a reference to, but it seems like to me he's telling Job, you are a wealthy man. You've got to quit depending upon your wealth. Put your gold in the dust. Sort of like the idea of what Jesus told the rich young ruler, go sell all you have. He found the guy's weak spot. And it may be that Eliphaz thinks this is a weak spot of Job. He is much too dependent for his security upon his wealth. So Job, if that's the way what's in your heart, if you're dependent upon your riches, then it'd be better if you put your gold in the dust. Get rid of it. Throw it away. The Almighty will be your gold. Your trust should be in God and your precious silver. For then you will have your delight in the Almighty and lift up your face to God. Verse 27, you will make your prayer to Him and He will hear you, and you will pay your vows. Verse 28, you will also declare a thing and it will be established for you. So light will shine on your ways. When they cast you down and you say exaltation will come, then He will save the humble person. He will even deliver one who is not innocent. Yes, he will be delivered by the purity of your hands. For the most part, Eliphaz's closing remarks there in 21 to 30 are some good advice. However, in a ways it leaves me with the impression that Eliphaz thinks deliverance comes from your works. Peace with God, blessings from God come, it's a swap off. If I do good for God, God will do good for me. And that type of thinking can carry you to hell, because your salvation is not a matter of a trade. It's not a matter of I give God my works, God gives me heaven. It's not a matter of we're graded on a sliding scale or a curve. And I'm not sure if how far Eliphaz would carry that. Perhaps he's not carrying it that far. But it kind of left me with that thought. Last point was Eliphaz gives one last plea to Job to turn to God. This is not the first plea that Eliphaz has made for Job to turn to God. It's not we've seen the same pleas or similar pleas from Bildad and so far to no avail. Job sticks to his guns. Job sticks to the idea, his belief that he is innocent. Next week, we'll see Job's answer. Let's begin in chapter 23. For two chapters, Job answers Eliphaz. So we'll catch that next time. Let's pray. Father, would you help us to glean from this book? Lord, the things we need to learn, God, we're so prone to slide into the world's way of looking at life. God, help us to place our trust in You. God, help us not to serve You so that You will bless us. God, help us not to love You so that You will love us. God, help us to understand that any love we have for You is because You loved us first. God, help us to see Your grace. Help us to see how deep and how wide it has been surrounding our lives. Lord, would You help us to see You in a more accurate light as we go through this book? In Your name I pray. Amen.